Welcome to This Is Money in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining editor Simon Lambert and I today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, family house swap, the answer to the second stepper's prayers. Profits matter, but which one? Simon busts some jargon. Plus, Marcus has competition, cash looks out for the count, and Lee retires at his coin man peak, just as there's a new coin in town. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving your little ones a head start with our junior ISA.
Now, much is made of the difficulties faced by first-time buyers to get on the property ladder, but less is talked about the issues facing second steppers. Now, as growing families struggle to afford to move up, could intergenerational house swaps be the answer? If so, what are the stamp duty and inheritance tax implications? And is it a good idea anyway, especially if you've got a big family? Simon, you have the case of Colin Messenger, 63-year-old Colin Messenger, and his family, the moment of inspiration that was struck on his holiday in Malta. What was that?
Well, the moment of inspiration highlighted in this story by our colleague Samantha Partington on Money Mail is that he realised that his daughter and her husband needed a big house. He and his wife were rattling around their four-bedroom house just 2 miles down the road. So, Colin thought, why not swap houses? Genius idea.
Legally so.
Legally so, yes. Mm. So each takes ownership of the other house.
Yes.
Obviously, if you wanted to just live in another person's house yes. and they lived in yours, then that wouldn't necessarily be a problem. Although, actually, weirdly, somewhere in your mortgage clause, there's probably something that says you can't do that. But they thought it through, and they thought they need more space. We need less space. Mm-hmm. Means we still get to live close together, because otherwise the daughter, Amicia Novak, and her husband, Dan, were going to have to move out of the area to find a bigger house because it's Twickenham in London, which is an expensive place. And so off they went and they did it.
So to be clear, in this case, it wasn't the fact that they couldn't find a house that's big enough. They just couldn't afford to move up.
Yes. Yes. So they were looking for a house that was bigger, but they couldn't stretch quite far enough. They bought their flat 6 years ago for £285,000. It was now worth £370,000, but they had a budget of £600,000, but they still couldn't afford the property they needed within the area. I mean, that just is an illustration of super high house prices, mm-hmm. isn't it? Now, the great thing is this works out for everyone, but there'll be lots of people thinking this sounds like a good plan. I mean, to be honest, my mum jokes about this fairly regularly. She lives in our, you know, family home, and I live in a flat in London. And she said, well, why don't we just swap?
Yeah.
The only problem is that my brothers and sisters might have something to say about that one, because I'm one of four. So you need a couple of things to work for this. And also, one of the reasons why we think about moving is to be closer to my mum, which doesn't really work if we just swap houses. We're still the same distance apart. So you need location to work. They say location, location, location on TV. Well, here's the fourth location. If you want to swap instead of buy, you need to be close. You need to be in the right locations to make it work. How many kids have you got? If you've only got one child, then this works fine, doesn't it? If you've got other children, they might have something to say about the matter. And then there's also some tax things to think about. Stamp duty, inheritance tax, both of those, there's implications for it. And also, if you're getting a mortgage, you need to make sure that the mortgage lender is on board with this, because ultimately what's happening is one party is gifting the other a substantial amount of money. And quite often a mortgage lender would want the party who's making the gift to sign some form of indemnity to say that they're not going to suddenly ask for it back.
So lots of considerations there. Stamp duty, £32,000.
Yeah. Pretty damaging, isn't it?
That's
considering a lot of nobody's
money,
actually
isn't it?
Technically buying a house.
But also, didn't they buy the house originally in like 92 for about 36,000, was it?
Colin and Marianne bought their terraced house in 1984 for 36,000.
Which is a lot about.
Today, it's worth £680,000.
House price rises and stamp duty rises, I imagine.
Yes, it does. Now, so the house, because the house is worth more than the flat, Amicia and Dan will have to pay stamp duty on £680,000, because the property that they are taking ownership of, they have to pay the market value of that. The stamp duty is based on the market value of that property, not on the gifted amount, that take off the gifted amount they're getting. So the tax bill there is £24,000. Colin and Marianne have to pay stamp duty on the value of the property that they're taking on, which is the daughter's property, which is £370,000. So that's £8,500. So in total, the exchange will cost the family £32,500. I mean, that's quite a lot of money in stamp duty, isn't it? Just for the privilege of swapping homes with your parents.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly, before stamp duty, just to put things in context, before stamp duty started to be hiked by a certain Mr. G. Brown as Chancellor, and then a certain Mr. G. Osborne jumped on the bandwagon himself and added in an extra few levels, it was a flat 1% above a certain level. So basically, had the stamp duty system remained the same, even with the stratospheric house price inflation that we have seen in recent years, the stamp duty bill for taking on the more expensive house would have been £6,800 rather than £36,000. And the stamp duty bill for taking on the cheaper house would have been £3,700 rather than £8,500. Now, put that into context in a scenario where house prices have gone up lots and lots and lots and lots, and people have to raise loads more money in savings to fund a deposit, take on much bigger mortgages and things like that. And you will see why the stamp duty system gets attacked by people as one of the things that is causing people to move home less and gum up the market. But that is an aside.
Taking that and putting that aside, Lee, generally, is this the answer to soaring house price problems and bedroom tax and all this sort of issues? Gumming up the housing market.
I can definitely imagine that this is going to happen more frequently in the coming years, because actually much is documented about how difficult it is to get a, you know, get a deposit and buy a first time home, for example. But actually not much as much is made about people trying to downsize. So this is a common problem for someone of the age, you know, your parents, you're in a 4 or 5 bedroom house, for example, your children have, you know, gone off, they've got their own properties or whatnot, and now you're this massive home, it's actually quite difficult to downsize. It's quite hard to find something that meets the needs and how it works. And actually, that can have a knock-on effect further down the market and make it quite difficult to free up properties, especially in that middle zone of, you know, where people are trying to trade up, perhaps from their first flat, for example. So I think we will see more of it. I was actually quite taken aback by the whole stamp duty element of this. I hadn't really thought about it before. Which I think is quite interesting. I think that might put quite a lot of people off from this whole element of swapping homes with their children, and the whole element of, if there are more than one child and how that all works, it makes it quite complicated. Not that many people just have a single child to swap a house with.
Yeah, there's also another weird quirk of the tax system whereby if you do something like that, so say, for example, someone dies and they leave the property to 4 siblings, for example, and then one of the siblings wants to buy the property and buy the others out, there's a weird scenario where if the others agree to sell it to them for a lower price to do them a favour, for example, they have to base stamp duty on the market value of the property because they're judged to be connected persons, and connected persons are close family relatives. And also, if there's been a period of time where, for example, the property's been owned and it's gone up in value, they have to pay capital gains on the market value of the property, not on the value of the property that they sell it for, if that's below the market value. So there's a couple of weird quirks in the tax law like that.
I just think if more people are going to do it and there's money to be had, the government will find ways in which to get money out of people. But there you go. Profits, so they say, are sanity. But the way that profits are reported by chief execs, by analysts, even journalists, there are many different profit measures, including gross operating, net, pre-tax, and it's a nightmare for investors as well, trying to keep track of a company's health. So how can you be sure that the bottom line, well, really is the bottom line? Simon, bust some jargon for us here, if you would. But before you do that, why are there so many different measures of profit?
Well, I suppose some of them have their merits. Some of them are just accountancy tricks. Accountancy tricks are used by companies to basically make themselves look better.
Right.
So sometimes they'll want to make themselves look better. So they will say, you know, underlying. So they'll report that they made a loss of £300 million, but underlying figures show that they actually made a profit of £200 million. And they'll quote the underlying figures and say profits are up. The reason for that is because underlying tends to remove what are considered to be exceptional items, one-off costs, things like that. However, you can often get to a scenario where the same company keeps reporting exceptional items and trying to claim their underlying profit figure. And there comes a point where once they have reported exceptional items for about 3 years in a row, are those items exceptional anymore? Sometimes they're even the same thing. Mm-hmm. For example, Tesco had a habit of doing this when it was winding down bits of its business after it went way too up in the sky and then started selling bits off. The banks are the masters of this. Reading bank profits is almost impossible. For example, they keep writing off one-off items which are basically paying out PPI compensation. Yeah. PPI compensation is not a one-off item. PPI compensation has been an ongoing cost for banks for quite some time. But so some of them have their merits, some of them don't. Some of them are just ways of measuring different things. So first of all, let's go with gross profit. This is the difference between a firm's total revenue, all the money it has come in, mm-hmm. and the fundamental cost of the goods sold over a period of time. The cost of goods excludes the often other quite hefty expenses related to making the sales. For example, bills, wages and other overheads. So many city analysts disregard this measure as a bit of an unrealistic indicator of a firm's health. It's sometimes called gross margin, can be very useful for more retail orientated companies because you can see from this what was the money they brought in and what was the cost of buying that stuff that they flogged to people. I, however, looked at the accounts of a digital company the other day, which had produced in its crowdfunding document the gross profit figure. It had the revenue and then it had the cost of sales that then gave its gross profits, which looked pretty good. And then it had its expenses, which massively outweighed all of the rest of it and indicated that it was actually making quite a large loss. And I did think, if you are a digital company, how the hell do you exclude these expenses from your cost of sales? Because you're not actually selling someone a physical product. You know, mm-hmm. the whole thing about acquiring customers, marketing yourself and everything, surely that is a cost of sales. Operating profit. As you might gather from the name, operating profit is calculated in the same way as gross profit, except it factors in operating costs like rent and wages. Widely accepted as the most important profit tally in the majority of situations, this is what is also known as earnings before interest and taxes, which is EBIT. Pre-tax profit. This takes into account all of the above, plus a business's interest costs on any debts. That can be quite important for a lot of businesses and is one to definitely pay attention to because, you know, when you hear about all these businesses that go bust and they fail, it's usually because of their debts and paying back the money on the debts. If you then include how much tax the business owes for the specified period, you can get another profit measure known as profit after tax or net profits. You can use that to work out a company's earnings per share. This is the amount of money they make for each share it is. So you can look at each share and go, okay, well, as a shareholder, if I own one share, am I getting a greater share of profit for this share every year? Retained profits, the amount that the company has left out after it has paid out dividends to its shareholders. That's quite important. And then we get to the favourite, the hot favourite, the one that everyone goes, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
EBITDA.
Yeah.
I know. So earnings before interest, tax. Earnings before
Take a run up to this, Simon. Come on.
EBITDA.
So it's EBITDA. You guys have practiced that. And what does that mean, Simon?
Earnings before interest and tax before depreciation and amortization.
And what does that mean, Simon?
The figure excludes underlying or exceptional costs that a firm thinks it will incur. For example, assets that wear out over time, that's the depreciation, and it's therefore a high-level measure of whether a firm is earning at least some kind of operating profit before funding capital expenditure. So, for example, you are a company, you are an early-stage company, and you are having to spend lots of money getting your company up off the ground. Are you profitable? Well, it doesn't look like it because every year you are making a loss, but if you use EBITDA, then you can show that without these big costs that you're going to incur early on in your business, for example, the cost of expanding your business, the cost of scaling up your business, the cost of buying materials, buying plants, if you're plant material, if you're an industrial company, things like that, that you are profitable. EBITDA is loved by management, but not necessarily by analysts because they think it can be a bit murky unless they are looking at smaller growing startup scale-up companies where there isn't a profit that they can measure, and then they do like to look at EBITDA. And if you are feeling that you might possibly be none the wiser after listening to all of this, I would advise you to go to thisismoney.co.uk/investing, where you will find this article and you can read it for yourself. And that will give you a better understanding than listening to me explaining it.
So in sum, there are lots of different ways to measure profit. Some are, how do we put it, massaging. Some are actually quite useful. But it depends on, if you're an investor and you're looking, it depends almost what industry you're in as to which one works well for you. But there's not one overall profit that could work in terms of indicating what's a good, healthy company.
Yeah, I actually, my favoured one when I'm looking at company accounts, the one that I always look out for is pre-tax profit.
Right.
There are ways of manipulating that. It's not always the most perfect measure, but it's a good measure. And the thing to do is to look consistently at the same profit figure throughout everything that you look at. So don't jump from one to the other, or don't just read the top line of what the company puts out. Companies put out their results on something called the RNS, the Regulatory News Service. If you go to This Is Money, look up a company's share price, you will find all of the data about that company that we have. Their share price move, the fundamentals, but you will also find a link to the RNS. That's where you find a company's results. If you're investing in individual shares, go look up that company, go read the results. Read the bullets at the top, read what they've said, but just remember, that's the bit the company wants you to read.
Mm-hmm.
That is where the company shines itself in the best possible light. You'll then probably get some kind of statement from the chairman or the chief exec, and then you'll get into the nitty-gritty. Go to the nitty-gritty.
Got it.
And have a look at the nitty-gritty. And if you see something you think looks a bit dodgy, go to that bit of the company report. Try to dive down into those profits, because that will help you understand how good that business is doing. And then compare the same thing back year over year over year.
All right. Well, talking of investing, talking of how well businesses are doing, just a really brief update, if you would, on Neil Woodford.
Yes. So, Neil Woodford, how's he doing? Not very well, really.
Yeah, I would suggest he's had better days.
I think he's had better weeks.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure whether last week was a better week than this one for him, to be perfectly honest. So the fund is still shuttered. Neil is beavering away in the background, shuffling deck chairs, trying to sell the smaller, unlisted, unquoted companies. The problem is there's an element of contagion. So I had it described the other day as everybody can see him coming, because everybody knows what he holds.
Right.
So everybody knows the things that he's trying to sell off. He's got to try and sell these off into a market that knows he's effectively a forced seller. 28 days is the amount of time the fund has to be shuttered for. Can't be less than that. Most likely going to be longer than that. I'm hearing talk that this could be a couple of months.
Yeah.
It's affected his patient capital trust, which is the trust in which he invests in largely in unquoted companies, because there's a crossover between the two, and people are now shorting the companies in that patient capital trust because they're saying that the value is probably going to go down. Neil Woodford being an investor in you is now a hindrance rather than a help. I think the other thing is his business going to survive this? So the business has grown substantially. It went up to £10 billion assets under management. That had shrunk to 3.7 by the time they pulled the shutters down. Obviously, if you grow a business quickly, you tend to spend quite a lot of money. And it's probably being done predicated on the amount of fees that they are pulling in. There's been a big pressure on him to cut those fees on that fund while the fund is shuttered. Can the business continue in the format that it's in? A lot of questions to be asked over that. I probably have my doubts, but you never know. Might manage to pull it off. All I know is that the tens of millions of pounds that Mr. Woodford and his business partner, Craig Newman, pulled out of that business when times were good is starting to look a little bit like it might have been a mistake. And there was a great payoff line amongst the thousands and thousands and thousands of words written about Neil Woodford.
It's been a lot.
Over the past couple of weeks. And it was Meryn Somerset Webb's column in the FT on Saturday, where she said that when Woodford launched his fund, he promised to make lots of people rich. And the only people who've really got rich out of it are Neil Woodford and his business partner. And that is a sorry tale. But you know what? Market turns around. He gets a run of good luck that replaces the terrible luck that he's had recently. You might find that when the doors to that fund open, it's up. could be up 10%, it could be up 15%. And then all of a sudden you'll find investors, some people will pull their money out and others will go, well, hang on, maybe he might be right and I might keep my money in there. And he did come out yesterday or one of the days this week and say, I'm really sorry. I'm sorry this has happened, but I still think my strategy is right. I still think UK-focused companies are massively undervalued. The economy is doing better than everyone thinks it is. Brexit will be sorted. And once that happens, whoosh, off we go. Also, the other thing I would say, that the greatest lesson you can draw from this is pay attention to what you're invested in. Now, Neil Woodford published a full list of his holdings, and there's been a lot written about the shift in focus of that fund. So people did have the chance to know what was going on. Pay attention to what you're invested in, and also pay attention on the way up as well as the way down, because there was an element of irrational exuberance here. Money flooded into that fund until it hit £10 billion. People were not paying as much attention on the way up as they have been on the way down.
Lee, you're nodding along there.
Well, I think this is sound advice, isn't it? I think it's what we touched on in the podcast last week, that, you know, Neil Woodford is human at the end of the day, and investing is for the long term, isn't it? You know, we always say a minimum of 5 years, but ideally longer than that. And I just... you know, you can't treat fund managers like a magic money tree that's going to keep delivering double-digit returns forever and always, because it's just not realistic. So I was just nodding along to Simon there because it's just, you know, sound advice, really. You know, more people should be not blindly putting money into funds like this if they don't fully understand, A, the risks, and B, what the money's being invested in. And now what's happened is the panic button's been hit, and especially in the last year, we've seen so much money pouring out of that fund, and you know, we're now at this situation in which it's reached complete and utter fever pitch. It's actually been really quite fascinating to watch it unfold.
Probably not fascinating if your money's all tied up in there, and all fascinating if you're Neil Woodford and that sort of thing. But yes, it's certainly great. Lots of column inches, so good for journalists. But I do want to ask you, Lee, has the star of another famous name in finance waned? I'm not really talking about a real person here, but Marcus. We talk about Marcus all the time. The offering from Goldman Sachs with its 1.5%. It was the golden boy of savings accounts when it was launched last year. But now, Lee, there is competition.
Well, let's go back to this. So last September, Marcus Bank, which is backed by Goldman Sachs, launched a easy access account here, which sort of blew out the competition elsewhere. And to be frank with you, that didn't take much taking. The easy access market has been low for a number of years now. It had launched in America a couple of years previous and launched a number of Best Buy rates out there. Now, I questioned at the time because within a week, 50,000 people opened that account, which is huge numbers.
I got one.
I think a lot of people from that point onwards continued. And I argued that there was a possibility that Marcus might pull that account or at least lower the rate, you know, tease people in. But they haven't. They've stuck to that 1.5% rate. It's exactly the same thing as they've done in the US. They've kind of kept the rate at the same level. And what's happened now is that if you want a slice of that easy access market and you want some of that cash, and you're having to match Marcus, because what a lot of people do is go to Best Buy savings tables, including our own. They see what's at the top. That's the best rate, and I'm going to open it. And that's what we kind of anticipate, a little bit more stimulation and competition. We've seen it in the fixed rate market. So 1 and 2 year fixed rates, for example, have gone up quite a nice amount in the last couple of years. And the reason behind that is because so many challenger banks have launched short-term fixed rates, because they're quite easy to manage. You've kind of got more of a handle of what's going to come in and for how long and how much interest you're going to have to pay on that. Easy access is a little bit more erratic because people might put in money in drips and drabs. I always call them a bread and butter account, because it's kind of like something that's just there, that's handy to just build up a pot. You're not really opening one of those accounts for the interest per se, really, because if you are, you're not going to earn an awful lot. So we've got a couple of challenges now into Marcus's crown. We've got four accounts all offering 1.5%. Interestingly, none of them have nudged over to go purely at the top of the Best Buy table, which is again what we often see in the fixed rate league tables. Now we've got Beehive. Now, I didn't know what Beehive was, if I'm being quite honest with you. So I got our savings reporter, George, to have a look and find out what it is. And what it turns out is that Nottingham Building Society, it's their online savings arm, and they've moved people with online savings into that. And now that is offering 1.5%, and that comes without a bonus. So it's a pretty good easy access rival to Marcus. Perhaps if you're not comfortable banking with Marcus, because some people, you know, they still remember financial crisis and Goldman Sachs. Some people are not particularly enamoured. Other people are just like, what's offering the best rate, and it's probably a safe place to put my cash. We've also got Synergy Bank. Now, again, if you're not familiar with Synergy Bank, that was once upon a time Bank of Cyprus UK. So it has some history of having an account here. That does come with a bonus after 12 months, so the rate will drop. And then we've also got the Virgin Double Take account, which offers 1.5%. The clue is in the name of that one. You can only touch your money twice a year. So it's not a pure easy access account. But a lot of people tuck money into those and they don't use it like a current account. Do you know what I mean? You put money in there and a lot of people probably access it once or twice a year. So it could be a good home for your cash. I'd be interested to see if any savings provider decides to dip over that 1.5% rate. It feels like the ceiling at the moment, and until that ceiling gets smashed, it's very hard to see rates going any higher. And as I said to you, Georgie, I think as a first time savings rate, if you're someone that has no savings and is about to start, it's not a bad idea to drip feed, you know, some money into an easy access account like this, because you don't know, you might need to access it at some point. It's more about getting into the habit than it is than chasing the rate.
Okay, so less really about a sign of better things to come, more about
more choice. I mean, and choice is no bad thing.
Beat what's already there.
Exactly.
Join what's already there.
There's billions of pounds of people's money, drips and drabs of easy access cash, dotting around all sorts of big banking providers. Some of it will be earning, you know, 0.05% or less. Mm-hmm. If you're one of those people, you know, that's what the banks want you to do. They want you to park your cash into an easy access account like that. And I think a lot of people could get into that trap of, well, I've not got an awful lot of money in there, let's say a couple hundred pounds or a couple thousand pounds, and they look at what rate they could get if they transferred it elsewhere, and it would be, you know, £10, £15 worth of interest. People go, oh, is it really worth my time? But unless that shift starts happening, as I've mentioned before, we won't see rates improve, because, you know, banks aren't having to battle for savers cash. It's just parked there.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving your little ones a head start with our junior ISA.
Now, how many times over the years on this show and in the press generally have we spoken about Britain's move towards a cashless society? Are we really ready? Well, it seems not everyone thinks so. The Bank of England, the Treasury, regulators, now banks are all clubbing together to ensure that cash is kept available for the millions of people who depend on it. So I won't go too much into the debate about it, Simon, because it does sort of feel like it's, one, a bit of crystal ball gazing, because we don't know, two, it's a bit boring now, isn't it? But what is happening with cash and the way that banks are getting together to try and ensure that people are still accessing it? Because, like I said, there are millions of people who genuinely depend on still using cash. People, small businesses.
Yeah. You think, well, I couldn't envisage a scenario where cash fizzles out and we go cashless. I can't really envisage one. I think people do still like to use cash. I know a certain person sitting next to me is a cash man.
I still like cash. I'm sorry.
I like cash. It. Yeah, I like to have some in my wallet that then remains in my wallet, and I pay for everything with a card.
No, I'm starting to get funny about the fact that, because I can see, I've got one of these apps that show you where you spend all your stuff. I'm thinking, I don't know that I like being that obvious. If I want to buy a house or something, you mortgage reviews, then they can look at exactly what you're spending your money on. And I don't like that. I also don't like to remind myself that I've spent however much going to coffee shop bar, coffee shop lunch, coffee shop. Rather than spending cash, don't spend at all is probably my advice to myself. But
yeah, so cash is kind of like a spending VPN, basically. People can't see what you're doing with
precisely.
Your money. Yeah. I think that I can't see us going cashless, but I tell you what, people use a lot of card payments now. You see so many people paying with mobile as well. It's businesses that are leading some of this. You're now starting to see places go, no cash, no cash, no cash, because it's a hassle handling it. Tills never balance properly. Also, it's quite expensive for businesses to pay cash in. They get charged for paying cash into their accounts. But what has happened in order to protect cash is that trade body UK Finance, which represents the big banks, building societies, has committed to work with the Joint Authorities Cash Strategy Group, the JACSG, to ensure cash is kept available to the millions who depend on it. It will work with the Treasury, the Bank of England and regulators to locate gaps in the country's access to cash, such as towns with a shortage of ATMs, branches or post offices. So that should keep the cash Fleming.
Call me cynical, but the banks clubbing together to do something that probably isn't profitable for them. Why?
Well, because they are banks, and so they must have a responsibility to ensure that people have money.
Sorry. Why?
Maybe have a sense of duty.
Well, no. Let's try that again. Why, Simon? It's not duty. It's not responsibility. What's in it for them? Is it because they're getting strong-armed? Is there a government, the Bank of England, the Treasury? Is that how they feel? Or
yes,
do they genuinely...
There's some concern. There's some, you know, some genuine concern from the authorities who say we want to still protect access to cash. There's other people in the banking, within central banks and things, who'd quite like us to go completely cashless, because then you could start trying to manipulate the money supply in that way. But that's a bit more complex than we should dig into at this time.
Lee, though, you like your cash, you like your coins, don't you?
I like a balance of both, Georgie. I think choice is always key in this sort of thing. And we're looking at countries like Sweden, for example, who've actually pretty much gone cashless. Mm. And I think that, you know, when we're in the southeast and we're in London and it's all well and good, you know, all these shops take card and it's easy. When you're somewhere rural, as a business, it's not quite as easy as that. And actually, there was some stats out from Which this week saying that 7 million people were unable to use their debit card last year due to some sort of IT glitch at some point in the year, which shows, you know, there are problems with constantly just relying on plastic. And also, touching back on the point that you were making, I'm not too keen on my spending being tracked, you know, all the time. I like to sometimes get some cash out. It's not like I'm doing anything dodgy, but it's just like I don't want someone to see how much I might be spending on coffee or in a fancy shop, or, you know what I mean? I like to have that kind of bit of secrecy around it, because data information is a value to an institution like a bank. So that's why I've always banged the drum that I think it would be quite a dangerous scenario to be in if we went completely cashless. There was also stats out from UK Finance last week that indicated that by 2028, so less than a decade away, just 9% of payments will be in cash. That's 1 in 10 transactions. It's incredible. The graph in there showed the debit card usage, quite driven by contactless as well, overtook cash in 2017 and is just on a completely upward trajectory. Interestingly as well, Simon mentioned about mobile payments, and we had an interview last week with the top UK MasterCard boss, who was saying that actually debit card payments, you know, they have kicked off, but actually mobile payments are where it's at now, because they don't even have to have a wallet. Yeah. Everyone's got their smartphone. You can load your card up on your smartphone.
It's always in your hand, isn't it?
But I mean, again, for me, that would be an issue, because the amount of time my battery dies on my phone because I'm too lazy to charge it would render me without money. So.
And also for the people that suffer from irateness, I'm not sure that's a word, it does take that extra 8 seconds to get through the barriers on the tube.
Oh my
which
word,
can really,
it winds
right?
me up. Oh, people paying by their mobile for getting through the ticket barriers in London.
It does
actually
take a little bit longer.
Why does it take so long? It's so counterintuitive.
The best ones when they're fiddling around trying to get their mobile up to pay for it, having just wandered slowly down the middle of the corridor reading the Metro in front of their face so they can't see where they're going, whilst clutching an oversized bucket of milk masquerading as a coffee.
What a can of worms I have just opened up there.
I still keep paper ticket for my train. I'm just don't want to go into the smart card. I'm just keeping it on the ticket. Paper ticket. What's wrong with a paper ticket? Except the fact it wears out every few months.
Yeah.
But what is wrong with a paper ticket? Again,
there's a lot wrong. Look, Lee, there's a lot wrong. One is you keep dropping it, and even if you've still got the receipt, Southern, you can't get a replacement. Two, if you fold it in your pocket, it doesn't go through. Three, if you have it by your phone, it ruins the magnetic strip. So again, you're that annoying person everybody's having a go at because it doesn't go through the barrier. But, you know, apart from that, I kind of like them.
It's true. Without sounding a bit James Bond-esque, a friend and I have this thing where we call going off-grid. And I quite like being off-grid sometimes, you know what I mean?
It's
like,
Terminator.
Exactly.
3.
If I've got a smart card, the smart card people know where I am at any given moment in London. Paper ticket, they don't know where I am.
But you see, you see these...
You sound so dodgy, Lee.
But you see these TV programmes, don't you? For example, Line of Duty recently. No spoiler alerts here, don't worry, for anybody watching it on catch-up. But there were times in it where people were questions about turning off your phone. Why did you turn off your phone?
Yeah.
You couldn't be tracked. Why did you turn off your phone? So, well, I'm entitled to turn off my phone. you know, we didn't fight back against the desire to bring in ID cards in this country, only to then just be tracked with our phones and told we can't turn them off. You're seen as guilty if you turned your phone off. I mean, obviously, Line of Duty is a fictional programme, so I'm not sure if this happens in real life.
Wait, though, wait, you will. I mean, you hear it in cases in America if someone's not on Facebook. That shows what a weirdo they must be. You're like, no, someone just doesn't want to be on Facebook. That says nothing about them. Anyway, we've just gone down a dark and gloomy tunnel there. Let's rip it back and let's get to happier times. But Lee, I'm devastated to read. Is this true? That you are passing over your Lee the Coin Man Boyce baton to George the Coin Boy Nixon.
George Small Change Nixon. That's his nickname.
All right.
Yeah, Georgie, I mean, you know, there had to come a point in which the coin baton was passed. I've had some big hits over the years.
You're a dad now. You've grown up.
Exactly. I'm going to be collecting the coins rather than be writing about them for my daughter. Yes, the mantle has been passed on in the safe and capable hands of George. A few years ago, I would have laughed at this conversation because there was no such thing. I won last year Coin Writer of the Year award. I think that was the peak. The absolute peak. I don't think I want to write about coins anymore.
Where can you go from there, literally? But you've done it, Lee.
But what I can do is I can be the overlord of coins and see stories come through and pass them on to George.
Right.
As in this case, which blew up, Georgie. Blew up. Yeah. Oh, my God. 85,000 shares on Facebook for this. 85,000 shares of some Peter Pan 50p coins. People are mad for it. They're mad for it. They love coins. I'm telling you, it's a phenomenon that, you know, we've gone from 1 minute here saying people don't want to use cash anymore to a moment where people all want coins. And you're not going to get coins unless you spend money in shops. Now, that said, these Peter Pan coins aren't going to be legal tender in the UK, so you won't get them in your change. What it is,
because they're not Royal Mint, are they?
They're not Royal Mint. So this is a company called the Westminster Collection, who do issue some coins from time to time and team up with people to issue coins. And they are with Great Ormond Street. So it's a charity-driven product that's been developed in the Isle of Man, or the Isle of Pan, as George cleverly put in the kicker.
Well, because there's a link, isn't it? This is to commemorate 90 years since the author, J.M. Barrie, gifted the character's rights to Great Ormond Street Hospital. So they get all of the
profit. So it's for
could they not wait for 100 years?
They'll bring something out in 10 years' time. It's fine.
Coins might not be popular then. It might be a 100-year anniversary coins. Mobile wallet app design, which just isn't as nice to hold in your hand, is it? So anyway, there will be 25,000 of each six designs going to circulation in Isle of Man. So if you happen, for whatever reason, to be hanging out there, you may get them in your change. There's been a real rise in these type of coins, Georgia. There's been the Royal Mint ones of Paddington, for example. Which proved hugely popular. We've had Beatrice Potter. Again, people were just collecting them, you know, out of their change. We had a Gruffalo coin. It crashed the Royal Mint website to get this coin. Now, this Peter Pan coin, when I took a look on the website first thing in the morning, literally just launched, I was in a queue of 3,000 people.
Wow.
To buy some Peter Pan 50p coins, as previously
Did
mentioned.
Did you buy one?
No.
All right.
Sorry. To,
how much did
they
go for?
No, I did not buy them. I think they were £6 or £6.50 for the set.
I'm talking about how much people are really going to be able to afford them for. Like,
well, this is it.
How much are they worth?
Well, this is it. We'll see them. I think given the popularity and what we've seen, and people really do like Peter Pan, the characters, so the coins feature Tinkerbell, for example, Captain Hook and TikTok. So, you know, people like these cartoon-type coins and they just like to collect them. I think actually, you know, all cynicism, cynicism aside, it is quite a good way to teach your children about money, you know, because we're in a danger in a spot here where children won't even see physical money because we're all busy using debit cards. And actually to have a physical coin in your hand as a child, I think shows you a little bit more about the value of money. But maybe that's just me, maybe I'm just old before my time, but I think there's been a huge drive in popularity of people collecting these types of things for their children, who get excited by the prospect of a Peter Pan on a coin. And I wouldn't be surprised to see more popular coins issued soon. Baby Shark 50p, wouldn't be surprised to see a Baby Shark 50p.
frozen 50p. I mean, I'm just wheeling off things I think kids like. Simon's
Peppa
probably more in the new. Would you buy a Baby Shark 50p coin, Simon?
Why have you had to put that in my head for the rest of the day?
Baby Shark 50p.
No, I would not buy one of those.
The advert would be great.
I would KLF them. Burn them. Burn the money.
Oh.
Yeah, burn $1 million or whatever it was.
Yeah, although it'd be a lot harder to do that with 50p's.
That's not getting melted down.
No, you'd need a furnace rather than a bonfire.
On that note, you can stay up to date with all the latest Breaking Money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you would like to make any suggestions as to what can go on coins, or you've got anything you want us to look at or investigate,
you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. You can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, where you can see all the podcasts past and join in the debate.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving your little ones a head start with our junior ISA.